Welcome. We are delighted to present to you a set of conversations with the pollsters who give lots of insights into what the Europeans of the different generations, different segments of the societies think about politics, what drives them to lending their support in the elections, what politics should all be about in the future. Welcome to this very special episode of FEPS Talk Podcast. It's part of the series where we ask pollsters what they think about the world, what we should be thinking about the world, and what are the biggest questions to anticipate on looking at the changes within the public opinion, especially in Europe. And today, together with you, I will have a very special treat. Kaisa Vatanen, who is the Chief Officer of Data Practice and previously also Director of Kalevi Sorsa Foundation, the President of Young European Socialists some time ago, I should say, but also the representative of the Finnish Social Democratic Party, one of the co-authors of the big programmatic platform at her times within the party, is here with us to answer some of my very pertinent questions. My name is Anja Skrzypek, I'm Director for Research and Training, and I will be very happy to moderate this conversation. Now, Kaisa, we are both incredibly enthusiastic about the European politics. Last year, big European elections. It was a big super electoral year. But of course, 12 months later, when we are meeting in this very heated day in Brussels, we can already see that there have been a lot of changes within the political landscape of Europe.
Indeed. First of all, thank you for the invitation. It's lovely to be here. And yeah, last year was a super year for democracy across the world. And I think what made last year so special was the kind of massive wave of anti-incumbency. There was not a one government that went to election that would have claimed to have really won the election. In the European parliamentary elections, in the all the national elections we saw across the world, the biggest trend was the anti-incumbency. This year, we are kind of expecting maybe something like this was to continue after the end of the year, obviously ended in a big way of the US presidential elections, and we had big elections coming at the start of the year. Namely, for example, in Australia, also the early elections in Canada, and there were opposition figures in both of them, which were styling themselves according to Trump, a kind of Trumpian MAGA movement, make my country great again movement. And we can see in both of those cases, but also in a lot of other countries as well, that didn't carry on over to this year. So this year we are seeing still calls for change, definitely, especially in our polling across Europe. We see that people still want change in their countries, but they also want stability and kind of respectful government, which is a big difference from last year.
But hold on. I mean, if you say respect, stability, predictability, and the notion of change, that would sound to me like there is a mood for social democracy. So how is that possible that social democrats are not exactly in the winning position when it comes to the elections?
That's a very good question. And I think that's something that if any one of us had a full answer, would not be sitting here, would be somewhere else.
Well, maybe we'll get to that. Let's be hopeful.
Yes. One of the things is that people still, overwhelmingly, if you look at the European countries, we in Data Praxis, we do a lot of polling across Europe, in all of the European countries, constantly. What we can see everywhere is that apart from very few exceptions, people still think that their countries are going the wrong direction, regardless of the color of the government. So a lot of people think that the situation that they have is not good, it's not improving, it's not even staying neutral, but it's going actively in the wrong direction. And there, that is where the call for change still comes from. But instead of being radical change, any change that we saw last year, now it's perhaps more directed at certain kind of, maybe the Trump and the global upsetness that his second term has brought has worried people. That's not the kind of change. We know what kind of change we don't want. Now the question is what kind of a change we do want. And then when it comes to social democrats, regardless of they are incumbents or if they are opposition, I think there's a lot of, if we look at the favorabilities of the parties or the leaders or the policies, there's a lot of dissatisfaction, there's a lot of frustration, there's a lot of calls for more of the very bread and butter politics that should be the core of the social democratic movements that people are not seeing. They don't feel that their lives are getting better, and they don't find the social democratic parties as the alternatives or the options for improving that. Very clear example is that when we ask people what are the most important issues or threats facing you and your family, cost of living comes on top on all of the countries that we're polling across Europe. And if you look at cost of living and whom, and then we ask after that, we ask who is the best party to fix that, to do something about cost of living problems, Social Democrats do not come at the top of the list. Apart with the exception of maybe Sweden and Denmark, in rest of the countries, it's either no one or more often than not the far right parties. And that should be very concerning for the progressive parties across Europe.
But in that sense, because you've mentioned already the one of the hashtags, as I think the current generation would call it, the issue of polarization and radicalization of the views. That was part of the rhetorics about how we should understand the results of the last year European elections. Do you still see it, or is that like literally a trend towards a certain direction in Europe? Because you said, listen, Social Democrats, it should have been the time, bread and butter politics should work, but it doesn't. But it's not the same sentiment of last year. So I want to drill you a little bit. So what is the sentiment? What can we expect from the elections that are ahead of us?
That is a very good question. I think there are multiple ways that I could come to that. But looking at it, first of all, I think the support for social democratic parties across Europe is still sliding. There are some countries in which it's improving, mostly in those countries where the social democrats are in opposition. They are gaining from the dissatisfaction, but especially in countries where they are in government, a lot of times in minority partners, there's a loss of support, and the far right is still gaining support across the board, that we know. Why is that then? Perhaps one of the reasons, for example, if we look at the recent German elections, what we can see is that before going into the elections, economy, cost of living, salaries, housing were the most important things for the people. But when you asked who has the most credible policies to respond to these issues, Social Democrats did not come at the top of the list. Part of it was because they had been running the coalition government and they did not deliver. Mm-hmm. You could say that they didn't deliver, or then they didn't have the vision for the future. And now the question is that what can you do? How can you both deliver the vision, but then also deliver the goods? And again, if we look at the not so great examples, what we're seeing in UK, for example, at the moment, people looked for stability and good governance and policies of the Labour Party. Year after the elections, we're seeing that there's a feeling of non-delivery, and which is very much creating feelings of dissatisfaction, anger, frustration, and then that is what leads people maybe to see that, okay, we tried these guys, we tried those guys, who are the next ones we can try? And that might be the reason why some of the people are looking for the far right. When we look at the reasons why people would not vote for the far right, the things that come on top of the list are things like they are too much like Trump, or they might have ties to dangerous people like Putin, or they are too radical. What does not come up is their not having credible policies. Actually, we do test that. We ask that as well. Do you believe that they would not deliver? That doesn't actually come to the top of the list. So that is not a disadvantage for them. That is something why people wouldn't vote for them. And when that is your most important issue, maybe that is what you're looking for as an alternative then.
It's a fascinating insight, because I think that within the traditional politics, the question of indeed delivery criteria is what in the mind of most of the mainstream or traditional politicians makes your mandate and your time in power justifiable, right? You have promised something in the spirit of the social contract that you close election after election. You have promised something, you need to deliver that. But isn't that so that, you know, there would be an excuse? Now, I'm playing a little bit the devil's advocate. I mean, there's so much said about the changing geopolitical context. And of course, you know, you go to the election at a certain given moment in time, but then the reality can be completely different a month later. So is it a fair thing to judge upon the delivery? Or is it just that, you know, one should get out of this framework altogether because the rules of politics have changed completely.
European electorates, especially, I think globally as well, but European electorates especially, were very forgiving during the first years of the pandemic. There was a lot of rally around the flag, and there was a lot of support for a whole lot of investment and policies going in to dealing with the pandemic. But there's a point in which you have to continue living the normal life, so to speak. And we can see if we ask the European electorates in multiple different European countries, what are the biggest issues facing, most important issues for you and your family, what are the most important issues for your country and then for Europe. And we can see that there is difference between the three levels. People kind of feel like they're going through this, or the world is going through polycrisis that there's a lot of talk about. But at the personal level, it's the cost of living. At the country level, it is, depending slightly where you are, a lot of it is either threat of Russia, it's the immigration, or it's the threat of Trump in case of Denmark, for example. Of but then at the European level, there's also the very real threat of the Russian aggression and the war, which is very close to us. Majority of the Europeans actually believe that there would be a further aggression in another country within the next 10 years when you ask them. And that alone tells you that people see and feel that there are multiple levels in which you have to work on. And politics has always been like that. You have to deliver on the personal level, but you have to also direct the country in the right direction. That's why we elect the politicians to lead the complicated issues. So yes, I think people are forgiving in a way that there are these huge global crises that we are going through, but at the same time, you have to deliver on the promises that you're making, because anyone having gone through elections in the past 3 years cannot claim that they didn't go through the elections in the middle of a crisis already. So if you made the promises in the middle of the crisis, you do also consider that to haven't been taken into consideration.
I mean, we've been discussing crisis a lot because crisis can be also an excuse or a disempowering notion where you think, okay, it's a crisis, so it's very difficult. However, you've just pointed out that during yet another health crisis, there has been quite of a response and quite a lot of understanding in between the citizens and the governments who had to meet relatively hard choices. And those choices were not only about how to ensure sanitary condition to prevent people suffering and dying in the very dire times, but also how to get together to go for the vaccine and all the protective measures that enabled us to unlock again. Now, again, there had been a lot of choices. And I think, you know, when we look post-COVID, those choices were read also differently by the different segments of the societies, experienced differently. So what about now? I mean, you've spoken about the insecurity issue. You've spoken about the global dimension. Mm-hmm. And your argument is people want to see the change in their wallet. They want to see the change in their household, in the public services sector. But then we hear that this is very difficult and we might not be able to afford it. So where is the public opinion standing on this issue of spending priorities and the choices?
That's a very good question. I think in the work that we have been doing, we've been looking a lot into, for example, defense spending and support for defense spending in this new situation, or in the kind of both in the continuing war in Ukraine, but also the role of US and the unreliability of US as the backer of the Western order, or however you want to put it. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, across Europe in different countries, we can see that there is a very strong support for increased defense spending. And we do often talk about that, yes, there's support for defense spending if it doesn't touch me, if I don't have to actually do anything about it.
Exactly.
So we have asked a lot about what conditions would you put on it. So do you support the increased defense spending if it increases the national debt, or if you would have to pay taxes, if people like you would have to pay taxes more, or if your services would be cut? And in most of the European countries, the support remains. Maybe not the majority as for the defense spending alone, but pluralities of people do still support it, and support is stronger than opposition. There are a few exceptions like Italy, where the support for that is not as strong, but in most of the countries it is. And I think there is a severe understanding or a serious understanding about the severity of the situation and of the need to protect. And I think that might be an opening for European politics as well, or kind of like more kind of European aspect of it as well. There's a serious understanding at the European voters that we need European responses. We cannot rely on the US in the same way in the foreign policy or security policy anymore. There needs to be European responses, whether or not it's a national issue or whether it's a European issue. And I think that would be something that would be very interesting to see how it goes and develops. But there's definitely an opening that if Europe would be able to find itself together as a union to actually develop some of these issues, that would be beneficial. That said, the bread and butter, the cost of living, the energy, the housing, regardless of what it is, it's slightly, the cost of living hides under it a lot of different things. In Spain, it's definitely about housing. In Germany, it might be more about salaries. It's in different countries about different things. But that remains the most important issue. So for progressive politics and progressive politicians to make a breakaway from that, you have to be credible in the new global order, in the new global situation, but you need to also have the solutions to help the ordinary people in their daily lives. Otherwise, you're not going to make the things to add up.
Well, Kaisa, I think that it's a great ending line because we've said at the very beginning it's very complex, difficult to understand. But through our 20-something minute conversation, we managed to unpack it and possibly discover one of a very important recipe. And as well, which is important for our European audience, see how much of an importance European vision should play in the social democratic vision, especially whereby the progressives are seeking a new chapter, renewal and a new outlook, which hopefully will be more hopeful. With that, I'd like to thank you so much, Kaisa Vatanen, Data Practice, a member of the Next Left Progressive Pollsters Network, has been yours and my guest. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
This series of podcasts is only part of the series of the FEPS talks. You can find many of them pertaining democracy, socioeconomic dimension, digital, climate, foreign policy, gender equality, and many, many others via our YouTube channel. We wholeheartedly recommend all of them to your attention. We would be incredibly, incredibly grateful if you felt like intervening and leaving your comments behind. Thanks so much, and I do hope to see you online and hear soon from you in the future.